We ask ourselves,
what is a Singaporean?
We are so many facets.
People from all races, religion.
It's not a homogeneous identity.
So if diversity defines its uniqueness.
So that's why it's such a difficult identity.
But what amazes me, of course, is how quickly we forget we had immigrant roots.
其实新加坡人是 很 proud of Singapore.
Good test of what Singaporean means is whether you stick to the principles of the country and values in times of crisis.
What makes me proud to be Singaporean is that I was born in the same year as Singapore was given its independence, 1965. So I always joke that after I was given birth to, late Lee Kuan Yew said, okay, now we can go independent.
Yeah, there are many things that I'm critical about Singapore, but having a lot of cultural harmony, whether it's enforced or not, I think that sort of steadiness and stability is something I am really proud of.
A lot of public media, there's always this effort to show all four ethnicities. That's the image that we have always seen around since young. I'm always trying to look for which of this do I fit in.
That's the typical four races holding hands. And you know that the four races because the skin colour is all different. It's not kind of like showing how nuanced each culture actually is.
We grew up with this whole idea of CMIO, Chinese, Malays, Indians and others.
In Singapore, all men are brothers. We are a people of many communities. And the happiness and well-being of each one of us depends upon our ability to be tolerant of each other, of our different habits of life and of religion.
We tend to think that this is a government ideology. It's of course a colonial legacy, these ethnic categories.
In the early 20th century, as a result of the census of population, these various ethnicities were lumped together and it becomes Chinese, Indian, Malays.
The problem is not so much these definitions, but rather that the communities have forgotten that it isn't so black and white.
The colonial masters maintain their rule is by conquering the minds of the colonized and making them believe that they were naturally inferior to the superior British. When we were young, we also believed that the British were the smartest and the best people in the world. And they were superior race.
The Japanese have been taught to look on themselves as a superior race of divine origin. You are to stand no nonsense from these people.
Some groups were in awe with the British because they were considered as modernizers. They brought development, they brought technology. But certain groups felt that they were left out and were not given equal rights.
We inherited the tensions between the races as a result of British colonial policies.
They developed very distinct views on different races. So quite often it was about drawing observations, but then saying, oh no, this whole group of people is best suited to a particular trade.
You start seeing these sort of stereotypes being built. One example would be that the Chinese were very industrious, but they had this tendency to love gambling.
华人的一个最大的特征就是想赚钱，真的就是赚钱。
So the idea being attached is that either they cheat a lot in order to be successful, or they are naturally hardworking. And we have to be careful with stereotypes because stereotypes are not real. The Malays, for example, were known to the British as being stereotypically lazy.
But the Malays were already landowners. They had little kebun, little plantations where they could live off the land easily. They don't know, be working in the tin mines in the heat and the rubber plantations and all that.
And because of their refusal to participate in that kind of exploitative economy, they were labelled as lazy and indolent.
Hey, Ali! Ali mi malevlam sin Ali malas. Hey, Ali!
There was a sense that the Malay community was not well suited to military training. With the Malay regiment, however, what the British found was, in fact, these soldiers were very responsive to training. And this was something that the British, it actually surprised them. The Malay regiment was involved in the last battle before the fall of Singapore, before the surrender, and really showed itself to be a force that had the utmost valour.
Every time we view things through a racialized lens, then that is something that is imposed from our years of domination. And decolonize is not just in terms of achieving independence, but also to decolonize the mind.
Saudara, saudara, saudari, saudari, setanah air, merdeka! Lagi sekali yang bersemangat, merdeka!
Singapore's founding fathers, especially Lee Kuan Yew, Goh Keng Swee, Rajaratnam, were as brilliant as the American founding fathers.
Mr. Rajaratnam, why has Malay been chosen as the lingua franca in a city which is predominantly Chinese?
Well, as you know, our country has three major races, the Chinese, the Indians and the Malays. And the only way we can implement our policy of creating a Malayan nation is to provide the people with a common language, and we have chosen Malay as the common language because the language, in any case, is spoken by the largest number of people in this country.
Melayu ada, India biantarian pun ada, Cina biantarian. Ini kita ambil, orang putih ni kenapa ambil?
Bahasa Malay was widely spoken, so you would imagine that that's the one language that people needed to pick up in order to survive.
So my parents, you know, can speak marketplace Malay. I probably can't go anywhere near that.
每天早晨，本班各学校的学生都学习唱歌这一科，他们所唱的都是马来亚的歌曲。
Just this idea of like Malay as a national language, I think it's okay, but it doesn't really have, I think, the kind of resonance that it used to in the 60s.
Speaking Malay does not make you more Malay. It makes you more Singaporean.
We are part of the Malay archipelago. Pre-colonial period, Singapore was part of the broader Malay kingdom of Johor and Riau. When we came out with the symbols, it was an adoption of those Malay features and Malay characters.
That, I think, was a strong sign by the founding fathers that they recognised Singapore's destiny would be tied to the Malay world.
So Singapore merged with Malaysia in 1963. Perhaps the merger itself would recreate this sense of common identity. But what happened was unfortunate.
A lot of these stereotypical ideas and suspicion and even distrust of the other races still persisted, and due to the volatile nature of politics at that time, it erupted into inter-ethnic clashes and riots.
My Malay neighbour got beaten up by a Chinese mob, and I have vivid memories of his face being beaten up and bleeding as a result of the riot.
The racial riots was a turning point that led to a rethinking of what is the best ideology forward. Do we want multiracial equality, secularism, political system? Or do we want a Malayan character making it more dominant?
Our convention will preach the gospel of a Malaysian Malaysian. Not a Malay Malaysian, not a Chinese Malaysian, not an Indian Malaysian, not a Thai.
Government of Singapore fought for a Malaysian Malaysia. The idea is that race does not matter. But I suppose the federal government in Kuala Lumpur had other ideas, right? I think they wanted a Malay-Malaysian.
They realised it's not workable and Singapore has to break away and reinvent itself.
There's nothing to be worried about. We are going to have a multiracial nation in Singapore. We will set the example. This is not a Malay nation, this is not a Chinese nation, this is not an Indian nation. Everybody will have his place. Equal. Language, culture, religion.
At that time, the idea that all races are equal and needs to be treated equally and be given equal opportunity is something that is progressive. In fact, even now also, it's a progressive idea.
And I think that is the basic foundation of nation building for Singapore.
Let us really, Singaporeans, I can't call myself a Malaysian now, we unite. Regardless of race, language, religion, culture.
Mr. Lee Kuan Yew was also signalling the start of the imperative to develop a Singaporean identity. So long as you are part of the Singaporean family, right, all the rights and privileges, you know, will be accorded to you.
I guarantee you this. There will be a constitution which we will get redrawn, in which anybody thinks he has been discriminated against.
And if he proves that it was because of these discrimination on grounds of race, language, religion, culture, then the court will have to enforce the constitution and ensure minority rights. We are an equal society. You are equal to me, I am equal to you. When we say equal, we really mean equal. We don't have to do it in Singapore, but we are thinking in terms of 100, 200 years, 1,000 years.
This would have assuaged the fears of minorities in the 1960s, I think, and made them realize that they had an equal stake in nation building. They were not encircled, vulnerable communities.
The fact that the government was prepared to put the commitment in the constitution, in the founding documents of Singapore, I think all that would set some amount of assurance. So sometimes we describe the constitution as the mother of all laws. Anytime we fall short, it doesn't just only break the law, but it may undermine who we are as a people. You're equal before the law. No laws, no policies, no jobs can discriminate on the basis of race or religion. And Article 152 directs the government to look out for the interests of the racial and religious minorities.
So there are a lot of safeguards, and that speaks about the progressive beginnings of Singapore.
I think in many ways we could also look at the pledge as a sort of mini constitution.
When it was first started, it was meant to be a pledge like the Pledge of Allegiance in America. So it became a school pledge. 1986, we decided to put that into the National Day Parade. It became a national pledge.
Based on justice and equality.
You repeat the pledge many, many thousands of times. You brought up with a kind of value system and it's become the way you see things.
I think what resonates with me in the pledge is all the ideals that we are meant to aspire towards, right? So, you know, regardless of race, language or religion is something that has been ingrained in us, or even the idea of justice and equality, prosperity and progress, right? I mean, all those terms are like almost kind of like part of our DNA now.
It's been said by Mr. Lee Kuan himself that it's not an ideology, it's an aspiration. But I think it's a wonderful aspiration, and I think a lot of Singaporeans feel very strongly about it.
Sometimes I think back to the pledge. When I see things happening in Singapore, that I feel like, huh, why is it happening? Why are people behaving this way?
Singaporeans tend to get very upset when we don't live up to these high ideals.
The line based on justice and equality, I think now we're just seeing more and more instances of inequality. the racial issue is always a thing that keeps popping up as well.
Along the years, there's been complaints about some sort of discrimination based on race, application of jobs, you know, stuff like that.
So when we say that a minority is not ready to be a prime minister, it implies that they are not good enough to be a prime minister. Then it dampens the aspiration and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and minorities will feel that they have nothing to strive for in terms of kind of equal opportunity that has been promised in the words of the founding fathers of Singapore.
We are still remain conscious of our ethnic identity. But at the same time, it's also very clear that the sense of a Singaporean identity is developing very strongly in Singapore.
Many Singaporeans identify themselves as Singaporeans first, and their race, their religion, their language as second. But I think we still have some way to go, perhaps even a long way. Nation building is never complete. It is a task that keeps going on.
So we really need to look into our history and see what had gone wrong and how we can get back on track sometimes towards this idea of racial equality.
Singaporeans were always very worried, you know. What hope is there for Singapore? And so Mr. Rajaratnam said, oh, the whole world is there for us.
Once you see Singapore as a global city, the world is the hinterland.
Singapore citizen now is a global citizen. You're global and you're local.
The idea is how do we leverage on our connection in the world, but at the same time, producing a population that will not be easily swayed by the politics that happen overseas.
The life and identity of a port city is dynamic and it's always changing. It's unstable, but we shouldn't fear it.
Singapore has always been exposed to influences from elsewhere.
The Queen's visit aroused widespread interest. This was demonstrated, for instance, in the large crowds in Toa Payoh when she visited the satellite town.
There's no longer the British Empire, but those legacies, the connections are still there between Singapore and Britain.
The Peranakans were really the main collaborators, the conduit for trade and port city culture. I think the Peranakans were very strategic. You see this photograph of Peranakan community leaders making this gift of a Queen Victoria statue.
To build monuments to figures like Victoria was really speaking to a sense of loyalty, a sense of pride in being part of the British Empire.
But they're all wearing Chinese kind of robes. It was an expression of how they were able to straddle and negotiate two identities. They really had this wonderful balance between all these powers, so chameleon-like.
Never believe that any great power is inherently benevolent, but you can also align your interests with them.
They engaged with Chinese politicians. Sun Yat-sen was clearly supported by people who were of Peranakan descent. And when he visited Singapore, they helped raise funds, they hosted him.
Go to the Sun Yat-sen Villa. What you find are names of people who have either donated money to the revolutionary cause, or they have gone back killed in efforts to overthrow the Qing. The anti-Manchu revolutionaries emphasize the uniqueness, the greatness of being Han Chinese. This idea of a Chinese nation and Chinese people is a relatively new one in the modern sense.
In the later part of the colonial period, we saw rising nationalism.
Several oral history accounts indicate that the arrival of Subhas Chandra Bose in Singapore was a turning point for the Indian community during the Second World War. It ushered in this great feeling of support for Indian nationalism.
My mother came a fervent Indian nationalist, a supporter of Mahatma Gandhi, a supporter of Jawaharlal Nehru.
And during one of Nehru's last visits to Singapore, he actively encouraged Indians here to see Malaya and Singapore as their new home rather than India. When Singapore citizenship was first made widely available, many people who qualified for citizenship have still had very strong emotional attachments to overseas homelands like China and India, of course.
没有可能在一夜之间就立刻改变得到。所以你要突然间让他们认同了，他们就是新加坡人，我觉得这是一个非常非常不容易的一个过程。
How far is the continuance of the present racial individualism an obstacle of a Singapore consciousness? The answer to this question must be approached by considering the strength of the various pulls exerted on the several Singapore communities from outside. Of these, by far the strongest pull is that of China on the local Chinese.
The voice of Chinese nationalism would naturally be more heard just by sheer numbers. You walk around Chinatown, you see a lot of clan association building. They provided a link to your hometown. What happened was there was communist takeover in China that reduced a lot of these linkages, especially as Singapore went on its anti-communist phase just prior to and after independence. I think Chinese people in Singapore focused more locally.
As Mr. Lee Kuan Yew emphasized the importance of English, the Chinese community began to feel like a minority.
其实我们那个年代突然之间转成英语主导的一个世界，对很多华校生来讲是很惨痛的一个经历，真的是很惨痛。真的，一夜之间你的课本全部变英文的，你们不理解这个痛苦。我现在 example， 你现在学校的课本全部变成华文的，看你怎么去读。
Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping.
Oh, my name is Pan Wenyu.
Very happy to meet you.
Deng Xiaoping's visit created a certain buzz, a certain excitement. Part of it was recognition that Chinese culture was something to be accepted and maybe even celebrated again. If Singapore we were to tap into this modern version of China, it would be to emphasize Mandarin.
In the late 1970s, when the Speak Mandarin campaign was first put out, the message was very strong. One is this whole labeling of the other Chinese languages as dialects. And dialects in itself is not a bad word, but used in this context, this distinction automatically tells you there is a hierarchy in these languages. So Mandarin comes up tops, and the other Chinese dialects had to be gotten rid of.
This emphasis that regional languages like Hokkien, Cantonese, Teochew, etc. were uncouth, were somehow of a lower socioeconomic status.
We had policies which almost completely banned the use of non-Mandarin Chinese languages on state media.
There was education policies in place that made it mandatory for all Chinese kids going to school to pick up Mandarin as the mother tongue.
Because of our bilingual policy and because of the importance placed on ethnic roots as part of government's policy, we have perhaps seen China as the sort of cultural motherland. That perhaps was very strong in the 80s and 90s. I think it's much weaker now, simply because of the recognition that China and Singapore are very different societies. And there are also concerns about whether China, in its foreign policy, sees Singapore as a Chinese majority nation state, and so may have that expectation that Singapore becomes supportive of whatever China does.
We should explain to China that an independent Singapore with a multiracial identity, which is trusted by its neighbors, can be a more effective partner of China in the long run than other than Singapore, which is seen to be a satellite state of China.
Having granted permission to China to establish a cultural center here in Singapore, there was that concerted effort for Singapore to have its own Chinese cultural center.
What does it mean to be Chinese Singaporean?
Singapore Chinese Cultural Center was set up by the Singapore Federation of Chinese Clans and Association. We celebrate the distinctiveness of the local Chinese culture, the way of life of the Chinese community here in Singapore.
Now, the Singapore Chinese Culture Center has a very different narrative about need to live or coexist with different ethnicities, with different religions.
We live in a multicultural environment. And this is why I think we were particularly excited when Neil Chua came to us with his proposal for Night Walker, where he wanted the traditional Chinese instrument, the ruan, to have a kind of a artistic cultural dialogue with Indian classical dance. And hence, we were very happy to commission this particular production.
It's very challenging because we have a different background. The communication actually is a very important part for us. We have a disagreement, we have to talk.
There's not always a necessity for harmony to be present immediately. This show explores the dynamics between these characters, and it brings the audience to a place where it's cohesive at the end. Cohesiveness would be the shared Singaporean identity.
People from two different communities just coming up with an idea to work together. It's very beautiful. Communities should feel free to borrow and be influenced by other cultures.
When they overlap, pop comes Singlish.
The first thing that identifies us all the time with Singapore English is the word, that magical word, LA. No, not Los Angeles, LA.
And we borrow words from one another like alama, la, kepo. And then with that also comes borrowing of food. As we know, Indians do not eat noodles traditionally. But when Indians come to Singapore, because they knew Chinese eat noodles, they created Indian mee goreng, which is famous now. Sometimes when
I feel blue, I'm like some... Because we live in a multiracial Singapore, the way Malay culture, Indian culture would evolve in Singapore would be very different from Malay culture, let's say in Malaysia, or Indian culture in India.
Every community being away from their motherland would adapt and adjust and improvise. The truth is, everybody was hybrid. It's about being very open and accepting and understanding about how we are so mixed up here.
We are only 3 million people. Just a little red dot on the map.
We must thank President Habibie, the man who succeeded President Suharto as President of Indonesia, for creating this phrase, little red dot. Singaporeans embraced this insult and said, wonderful. You are a little red dot.
It's like that song goes like, there was a time when people thought that Singapore can't make it, but we did. You know, that's very underdog.
Being Singaporean to me is also about to beat the odds and to achieve things that you would not imagine a small country can achieve.
We are competitive. That's how we won a gold medal in swimming.
You know, like when we grow up in Singapore, the one thing we always hear is that Singapore is small, we have limited resources.
And in that sense, that's kiasuness, because we don't have the natural resources, we are the resources.
Natural inconfidence is in us that we are a small nation.
We're a little red dot.
That's where your sportsman will stand up and say, no, we're not.
This young man from Singapore, he has been so impressive.
I was in Rio. Unfortunately, I didn't have tickets to watch the race, so I was watching it from the TV screen there, just like probably every Singaporean from everywhere in the world.
I was lying on my bed watching the final that Joseph Schooling swam.
When that race started, and Joe usually has a nice little puff, you know, with a loud whoosh, and I heard that, and it all went quiet. That was when, you know, I couldn't breathe for a while. Take your arm.
Schooling's reaction time in the semi-finals was the best by far of everyone, and he starts well again.
It's very much like the hopes of an entire nation are very much pinned on his performance.
I was just biting my fingers throughout.
That Schooling's looking good and right on that world record time.
Because he led after 50 metres, and for me it was like, you know, just hold on to it, just hold on to it. Your heart's just pounding and racing. with him. It was another one of those beautiful moments where I felt that 5-6 million people were feeling the same way that I felt in my heart. And that for 50.39 seconds, we were all together as one.
We were hoping to see history in the pool, but we are history because Singapore has won an Olympic gold medal. Joseph Schooling.
And I remember watching it, and when he won, I screamed. And I heard other people in the HDB block that I was staying at also scream. And that was so magical.
I was very, very happy. In fact, I think like maybe I teared. Just, you know, quite swept up in that achievement.
It was the greatest moment in our sports history. We finally had something lifted off our shoulders. We have finally won an Olympic gold medal. We had the big, big superpowers. And a Singapore boy emerged on top of it all.
In spite of being a small country, in spite of not being the tallest and the biggest of all Olympians, Joseph Schooling managed to show that you can be the champion if you put in your heart and soul. And he actually inspired Singaporeans to start believing in themselves.
Just makes you feel very proud. Suddenly you're like feeling Singaporean at high peak levels. Yeah.
There was some discussion about Joseph Schooling in terms of identity and, he doesn't sound Singaporean. Why is he training overseas? I know that this was something that I found troubling.
I think the debate about Schooling's Singaporeanness, I just found it sad that people were questioning it to that extent.
He is a fourth generation Singaporean, born in Singapore, raised in Singapore, has done significant schooling in Singapore. If that's not Singaporean, I don't know what is. Because then people like me also will be quite worried.
And there's almost like a policing, right, of what people think a Singaporean should look like. Of course, it happens to a lot of other minorities in Singapore as well.
And his father had to come out and, you know, tell everybody that his son is Singaporean, he is Singaporean.
Nama saya Colin Schooling, anak berna Singapura. Lucung nang kong wa, what do you call it, lang mo nang. Singapore nang.
And if you know Colin, he's one of the funniest guys in the world. In his own novel way, he responded to it, which is to speak in Malay, Chinese, whatever it is, dialect and all that kind of stuff.
It really speaks to a much longer tradition of whether we call it Bazaar Malay, language that you would hear around the wet market. And to do that immediately had resonance with people because then they say, oh, yeah, this is a Singaporean, you know, this is a Singaporean family.
I actually found it a bit sad that Joseph Schooling's father almost over-explained the fact that they were Singaporean. That incident actually made me realise that people don't really know what it is to be, let's say, Eurasian.
He is proud to be a Eurasian, so it's within his rights to say that, you know, the Eurasians play an important part of Singapore's history. Being a Eurasian myself as well, you know, I was happy that he said things like that because it reminded me that, yeah, we play a very important part in Singapore's history too.
I think we do not know how to celebrate our heroes in a very popular manner.
If you are Brazilian, gosh, every Brazilian knows every football hero, right?
You go to Brazil, you get a Pele t-shirt or boots or something. So Singapore is still lacking in that.
That's why I have actually advocated that Singapore should go back to the Malaysia Cup. I was present in Kuala Lumpur in 1977, where in the face of a very hostile crowd, Singapore won the Malaysia Cup. Boosted the sense of pride in being Singaporean in Singapore enormously.
Everybody had their own personal heroes. I was doing Hades pretending I was Kwa Kim Song on my bed because he was my hero.
Number 11, Kwa Kim Song.
So we had heroes who were of different races. We didn't think about that. We just thought, oh, he's a great footballer. I had aspirations to be a Singapore football player. So football was a big thing in my life when I was young. My dad used to take me to the football matches at the Kallang Stadium, witnessing the Kallang roar.
It was loud. That's why it was called the Kallang Roar. And if you're on the pitch, if you interviewed any of the players playing there, they could hardly hear themselves.
It wasn't whether you're a Malay, Chinese, Indian, Eurasian. It was the Singapore team. We were supporting them. And we were all swearing in all various languages, but it was part of the whole fervor. At those moments, you do feel Singapore without thinking of the politics.
We didn't know each other's names. We still didn't after the match was over. But we found ourselves either holding each other or having the same sort of feelings. And gosh, 60,000 of them. That is what's the magic of the National Stadium during that period of time.
I miss it so much. My one regret is that I never saw a Malaysia Cup game at the National Stadium live. That's my biggest sporting regret in Singapore.
So teams of the past especially, right, you had quite a mixed bunch of players, right? So you had a Chinese goalkeeper, David Lee, and yes, Fandi Ahmad.
Soccer is my game.
You have Sundram, who was Indian, and so on. And it's easy to recognise them as Singaporeans, to say that, hey, that's what our society looks like. You know, I easily identify with that team.
You had a football team of every race, shape, size. They really could not sing, but I knew the lyrics. I had a jersey. My friends had jerseys. And it really felt like that was something that really brought the country together. Like, even my mom knew Fandi Ahmad, or Sundram, or Nazri Nasir. Which is a very magical thing. Like.
They were real heroes. They were the Avengers because they just brought us up to another level altogether in terms of happiness.
Wham, bam, it's a jam, I'm Abbas.
Even as we did have some, even at that time, international players like Abbas Saad and Alistair Edwards and so on. Singaporeans were quite accepting of them as, in fact, Singaporeans. People were perhaps more innocent and naive. In the 90s.
I'm Zhang Zhong. I will take you off. We will take you
off. And to be fair, Zhang Zhong and Abbas integrated. They hung out with the locals as well. I don't think that they even thought Zhang Zhong was Korean.
A sea of red and white, the Singapore faithful, nearly 50,000 of them, turned the Shah Alam Stadium into a mini colour.
So one key memory is the 1994 Malaysia Cup final against Pahang.
I was there when they won it at Shah Alam Stadium. It was a great team. There was Fandi, there was Abbas Saad.
Talent plus chemistry, it all came together for them. And that's what made the team very special.
I didn't see Abbas Saad as an immigrant. I saw him as a Singaporean. People didn't necessarily question people's nationalistic loyalties at those times.
And they were 4-0 up, but they were going for more.
Let's push the ball inside for Abbas Saad! Abbas going to score his hat-trick!
Oh, yes!
With this beat on the four now, Fandi was a side roll!
What a tremendous display!
So I think that was what the beauty of that team was. They were willing to die for the cause. And it inspired us to die for the cause as well. After that, I remember interviewing a couple of players. You could just sense the euphoria there.
As a player, I'm very proud because this is a history for Singapore.
There were whispers, but I don't think the players knew it was the farewell to the Malaysia Cup.
Taking Singapore out of the Malaysia Cup at one time was, I think, a bad move because there are very little things that we can do together as a country.
We don't have the Malaysia Cup anymore. So what we have is a local league that pales in comparison in terms of tribalism and national pride that can come into play.
And unfortunately, for a lot of people, the national football teams turn probably into an ex-love. And it's painful for me to say that because it still is my first love. But for some people, it's probably the ex-love already.
In terms of recapturing the magic, I think there is this possibility of doing it. I think the fervour for local football is certainly still there. We see this in, for example, school team matches. The powers that be have to somehow harness this latent energy that's always there in support of football.
It's a good rallying point, you know, to bring the country together. We need those things to make people feel naturally, to feel that we're together. It's important in nation building.
You know, a lot of people, like in South Asia, people think that Singapore is part of Malaysia still. And in like places in the West, people think that Singapore is like part of China, like Taiwan or something like that. So if you don't know your history, then how are you going to correct people when they impose certain ideas, you know, of your country onto you?
when we separated from Malaysia, I think we took it very seriously that the government will provide housing, education, healthcare, and everything else while the people work hard for the country, for the economy. But Singaporeans themselves, during that era, didn't really feel a sense of, this is my country.
以前我们那个年代，你讲我爱新加坡是吗？人家一定说你神经病。
But closer to the 1980s, things somewhat took a change. So we moved from building a country to building a nation in the hearts and minds of every Singaporean.
From the 1980s onwards, there were fears that globalization was producing a kind of rootless citizenry.
Many Singaporeans, especially pupils and the younger citizens, knew very little about our own recent history. They didn't know how we became an independent nation, how we triumphed over long odds, or how today's peaceful and prosperous Singapore came about. This ignorance will hinder our effort to develop a shared sense of nationhood.
So, in order to stem this, the government took an active interest in framing the so-called Singapore story, the framing of Singapore's history. This resulted in a national education program in the 90s.
Nations, they write their histories. They want to be able to mobilize. They want to be able to get people to sacrifice. So, in the Singapore case, there's this emphasis on this sort of rags to riches story, right?
No other country has succeeded in improving the living standards of its people as quickly and comprehensively as Singapore has done so ever in human history.
When we do national parades and people look at old footage and say, oh, we were like then, oh, this happened, oh my goodness, I didn't know we went through all that. And hopefully that plants a seed and then they think like, okay, maybe I can do my part in building this nation, but also knowing and being grateful for what's happened.
Probably worked for the earlier part of our nation building, but we also have to recognize we will have our fair share of knocks. There'll be times when we're less successful as our situation changes. Maybe those historical narratives that we have, they can be improved upon.
Our historical narratives have broadened. For example, we used to look at Singapore from a 200-year lens. Now we look at it from a 700-year lens to give us a broader perspective on regional developments and the rise and fall of polities in Southeast Asia. There's also been a lot of interest in getting the perspectives and voices of ordinary people inserted into these big national histories and national narratives as well. And public institutions like museums are much more consultative as well, and members of the public are happy to share their views with museums when it comes to curatorial decisions.
And ultimately, this kind of realism and diversity will provide a much more resilient foundation for us to develop our history. We have to realize, accept, and celebrate the myriad voices.
I think this is very important because when a thing happens, different backgrounds always have different analysis, different views.
It's true, like the current modern Singapore, we owe it to Mr. Lee Kuan Yew and his group of visionaries. But there were many, many, many founding fathers, and the history stretches all the way back.
The early immigrants who came largely from China, India, Ceylon, and Indonesia, were largely anonymous, humble folk.
The immigrants were not locusts
who had their fill and left the desert.
They found a desert and left behind a throbbing, dynamic, and prospering city.
A modern, multiracial, multicultural, and multilingual Singapore.
When we're setting up a nationhood, there has been a lot of effort to make sure that people from different backgrounds feel like they belong here.
I'm not sure if the narrative has been lost like throughout the years or like as we grew to become a global city.
So if we can make space for newer migrations in our historical consciousness, in our historical narratives, then we can perhaps come to a more inclusive understanding of the place of migration in the continuing and evolving story of us.
Okay, in 36 BC,
I think my family history is a little bit confusing or complex, like many people from Singapore.
My grandfather actually was from Fuzhou, China. By today's standards, he would be considered sort of like an illegal immigrant.
Some of my ancestors were from southern India, and some of them were from Fujian province.
Yongchun County in Fujian province.
Yongchun County in Fujian province. and moved to Malacca.
From Malacca, as well as Banjar in Indonesia.
The various islands of the Malay archipelago.
This island called Bawean, which is in the East Java.
It's a mix of Javanese and also from South Asian descent.
My grandmother is Malay and my grandfather came from India.
Indian and Arabs via Uttar Pradesh, northern India.
My parents came from Sindh. Sindh, which what I understand now is part of Pakistan.
Part of my ancestry actually comes from India. So from Kerala,
from a coastal town in Tamil Nadu.
A little village in southern China.
Tanzania, which is in Africa.
I'm from Australia.
My dad's mum, she came from Penang, and my dad's dad came from England, and they met during the war.
My father was born in Malaysia, specifically in Ipoh, and my father decided to come to Singapore and find his fortune here.
We've been in Singapore 4 generations at least.
3 generations before me.
I'm only a second generation Singaporean born. But what amazes me, of course, is how quickly we forget that we had immigrant roots. Perhaps a reflection of the success of nation building.
I really feel proud of where we are. Feel proud of what we've achieved and what we've gone through. Even now, I'm a bit teary now. Because our forefathers worked so hard, they literally broke their back to get this country where it is now.
Singaporeans are very proud of Singapore. 我对自己呢是一个新加坡人呢，我还是一直觉得非常非常的骄傲。
And I think we should all look back at pride because it's amazing that we can build a nation in the hearts and minds of Singaporeans over a mere 50 years, you know. In other countries, it takes much, much longer.
And Singapore's identity is very much a work in progress. I think it will take maybe another 50 to 100 years for it to be clearly crystallized.
The beauty of the Singaporean is that he is not definable. We are so many facets, and it's dynamic as well, so we keep changing. Some people might think that this sounds dire because what can we sort of pin our identity on, but that is what makes us special.